My name is Lynn Oderkirk, and my charge is to talk to you about applications of the recommendations that came out of the Early Childhood Obesity Prevention Policy Report. The down arrow it is. I have no disclosures. The question is, why would we look at early childhood settings? And early on, our committee was charged to really consider broadly, recommend policies across a wide range of settings and programs. And in doing so, we kind of had to think about where it is children live and learn and play in those years from birth to 5 years of age. And ultimately, we came up with three recommendations. One is childcare settings, where so many of America's young children spend good parts of their day, actually on average about 28 hours a week for a child in care. And second is the healthcare settings, where they receive their well baby and well child visits and participate in WIC clinics, are seen by lactation consultants and the like. And finally, those policy avenues, meaning the decision makers in federal, state, and local government, as well as private entities who really have the potential to change the community, the larger community in which our children grow and develop. So those were ultimately the three settings that we determined we needed to address in this report. And as I talk today, I'm actually going to take you through a discussion of action steps by those settings, because I think it helps you, helps us all see where the action steps might likely occur. Why would we pick childcare settings? There right now, today, are 12 million children in the U.S. in childcare under 6 years of age who are receiving childcare, and as I mentioned, the average number of hours in care is about 28 hours per week for a child in care. About half of those children attend a child care center, a licensed child care center. The other attend any of a number of other child care arrangements, including family daycare homes, group family daycare, preschools, Head Starts, and kith and kin care, which is known by a lot of names, informal child care, relative care, and things of that sort. But there are a lot of children in these settings, so it certainly is an area where we have a potential to reach a huge number of children. Secondly, as Deborah pointed out, the child care environment during these early years, child care workers have a tremendous opportunity to role model excellent eating and physical activity behaviors, establish sleep patterns and practices regarding sedentary behavior that really have the potential to have a major impact on these young children. Finally, child care may or may not be regulated, and the degree of regulation varies quite significantly by state. And this is where I'll just bring you all up to a common place. Many of you are probably well aware that child care licensing is a state prerogative. While almost all states, and I actually believe, come down, there are very few states who don't regulate child care, and I think actually now none. But the kind of child care regulations vary widely. As an example, in 80% of states, they have a regulation which requires that water be available and accessible to children in care. 80% of states. Yet only 20% of states have a regulation that the child care setting must support a breastfeeding family. In addition to that, I have a couple of other statistics that I think it's important to remember. One in three states have specific language regarding screen use in child care, and even less define the number of minutes of physical activity that are appropriate in a child care setting. So few, if any, states have regulations in place that comprehensively address all of the health and wellness goals that we recommended in our report. So there certainly is somewhere to go relative to child care regulation. While our committee specifically recommended mandatory improvements, so in other words, changing mandatory child care regulation, which is has the force of law, we acknowledge and, and accept that in many states this is going to take some amount of time, and we also have to look at voluntary measures as well, and many states have those as well. Examples would be quality rating improvement systems, early learning standards, incentives for quality care. Some states have financial incentives for quality care, and certainly there are nonprofit accreditation standards, and even something like Michelle Obama's Let's Move Child Care, other voluntary actions that states or localities might take, or private nonprofits might take, to move this discussion forward to improve the quality of care. So now I'm going to take you through a few action steps that might be appropriate. And first is, and we've talked a lot about it, and probably the most important as it relates to the child care setting, would be to strengthen child care licensing laws. Most states, quite honestly, would fail if evaluated against a standard of health and wellness in child care. So we have a long way to go, both in terms of mandatory changes, mandates in child care licensing laws, but also voluntary requirements. So our recommendation and action step would be to, for example, require child care programs to provide opportunities for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers to be physically active throughout the day. Our report gives a lot of specifics to that recommendation, and I'll refer you to the report for those, but that would be one. Another would be to decrease sedentary time and screen time in child care day, to promote breastfeeding, to require healthy eating in a responsive feeding environment. This is a huge recommendation, which I could talk about for hours, but I'll refer you to the report for that. And finally, to instill appropriate sleep patterns. In order to accomplish that, there are a couple of really critical steps that must occur, which I'm going to refer to now, and Deborah certainly spoke of earlier, and one of them, and actually interestingly, came out of the CACFP report. One of them is the need for us to address the education of those practitioners who provide care to young children in child care settings, so child care providers, early childhood educators, and the like, child care health consultants, etc. All of those individuals who directly care for our youngest children, there's really a need for them to be educated on what it is their role is in reducing obesity risk among children birth to five, because they need the knowledge first. And the way they get the knowledge is if we integrate that education into their degree programs, into their certification programs, and into their continuing education requirements as well. So we really need to provide the education on those recommendations I talked about with the mandates and make it part of all early care and learning education. Some suggestions we could take on to do that, one of them would be to work with our state licensing agency. For example, they could mandate that obesity prevention training be part of the required training requirement every year. In fact, in New York, we've been working really hard on that particular recommendation to be part of our licensing requirement. If it wasn't going to be mandated, maybe they would at least allow obesity training on any of these areas of obesity prevention, risk prevention, allow that training to count, even if it's not mandated, to count toward their annual requirement. That would be another, certainly important requirement. Secondly, it could be to ask that we have consultants come into the child care directly every year to evaluate the setting, the environment of the setting in these areas of physical activity, screen time, healthy eating, et cetera, sleep patterns, but also do that consultation right on site, which was another recommendation of our committee. Next and finally, in order to move ahead, and this also was a consistent message we heard with the CACFP report earlier, efforts to reduce obesity risk will be more successful when child care providers feel comfortable engaging parents in this discussion. Our committee talked a lot about that, and we acknowledge that it's first step is for these child care providers to have the knowledge and the belief that they can make a difference and they know how to. And secondly, and not to be confused, is to develop the skill to work with families to communicate that message, to say, we're in this together, let's work together, let me advise you. We know that parents look to child care providers for advice on child rearing and child development. What a wonderful opportunity to communicate these messages. And I can give you a couple of specific examples. I mean, one would be, we talk about screen time and the recommendation is no more than 2 hours a day. Well, that 2 hours a day is total. What do they get in childcare versus what do they get at home? So one example would be for childcare, and I like to think a less challenging interchange than perhaps talking about health patterns, et cetera, would be to talk about that specifically and say, we're going to be doing this screen activity tomorrow, so I'm going to tell you your child will have been had a half an hour. You know, keep that in mind in terms of your total, or just making sure that parents understand about why they would want to limit screen time and strategies for getting around it. So that would be the third and final action step we would see in child care settings. Next, we talk about healthcare, and certainly, once again, it's why did we pick healthcare? Because it's an avenue to reach millions of children with well baby visits, with WIC clinic visits, well child visits, etc. Healthcare practitioners have the potential to advise and counsel about child development and health behaviors. Our primary recommendation in the healthcare arena was that they monitor growth. Deborah talked about this. The concept is that at every well-child visit, standardized growth assessment be used to measure weight, length, and height, that it be charted on standardized charts, which is the next most important, and in the same way we talked about childcare, that healthcare practitioners communicate that with parents. So they not only look at the child's growth patterns, but they also look at the parental risk factors as well and use that information to communicate with families. Certainly that will require, in the same way that we must educate child care providers, we also must educate healthcare practitioners to understand why children at this early age are at risk and what their role is in reducing obesity risk. And finally, once we've done that, in the same way, we have to educate them through their degree programs, their pre-professional practice experience, their continuing education programs, advise them on how do I counsel patients and families about growth and about healthy home behaviors. I've been given a little note that I'm kind of running out of time, so I do think it's really important to talk about the third avenue, which is policy avenues, because certainly through federal, state, and local government and through private nonprofit work, we have a potential to improve the communities in which children and families live and grow, and also to the potential to address gaps in knowledge and access, both of which are really critically important. First, and Deborah talked a lot about this, one would be to limit exposure to food and beverage marketing. We certainly could do some of that through, the FTC, USDA, FDA, CDC, really establishing and monitoring uniform national nutrition and marketing standards for food and beverage. Second, and I think Deborah also spoke a lot about this, I've talked to you how much our committee felt it was so important to educate providers who are interacting with families, but also educate with the families directly. All of this, I cannot tell you how important the committee felt it was that we have consistent messages to communicate. The social marketing campaign would be one example, and I just point you to an example like Back to Sleep or Tobacco or Car Seats for Children. There are successful examples of social marketing where everyone has gotten on board and understood, but it requires simple, practical messages which can be interpreted by all members of the community. There are certainly lots of gaps in knowledge and access, and I'm going to finish up by kind of going through a few. When we look at gaps, Deborah talked a lot about the need for more research for this population and the need to evaluate our recommendations once more research is available. Another piece I want to point out is that, for example, we talk about needing to educate healthcare practitioners and childcare providers, but that will require having a cadre of professionals who are knowledgeable in this area. And in two specific arenas, we don't have that group. That would be physical activity, understanding how to work with 0 to 5 developmentally appropriate children with and without special needs. How do we do that? Number one, physical activity. Number two is sleep hygiene. We really need to look at how do we prepare the experts who will ultimately train healthcare providers and child care providers. That would be another gap we have to really look at. The dietary guidelines we spoke about is another gap where we don't have dietary guidelines for children birth to 2. Access is a huge issue because until families can get access to foods that promote good health, to physical spaces where they can be active with their families, it becomes very hard for them to adopt healthy behaviors. So certainly in terms of access, we can look at avenues, joint use agreements that allow public buildings to be used for neighborhood children in off hours, playgrounds, ensuring that they have equipment that is appropriate for children birth to 5, safe and appropriate and accessible. Those are a couple of examples. Certainly there are many more. Increasing participation in federal existing nutrition programs such as the SNAP program, which used to be known as food stamps, WIC, CACFP, that they would be examples where we can boost up the accessibility and availability. And certainly another would be working, as was written up greatly in the local government's IOM report, ensuring that all communities have access to grocery stores that sell the kinds of products we wish families to consume. We have a lot to do. Our committee feels that the need to address childhood obesity in the 0 to 5 population is critical, and we all have a role to play in reducing obesity risk. In developing recommendations for action, our committee targeted those adults with the greatest potential to reach a large number of children, and ultimately through them, their families, parents and families. The actions we recommend can be implemented by child care providers, by health care practitioners, and by the community at large. Some of these actions will be easy to implement, others will be really challenging. Some can be implemented at modest cost, and others will require tremendous investment of resources, both financial resources as well as time. I urge each of you to take a look and consider what you can do to advance this forward, and I thank you very much for your attention.